It was more than one, she replied tensely. The Hyraks control the Grolems now that Tuchek's dead. They have joined their wills to try to kill Erand.
The others, awakened by her sharp cry, were stumbling to their feet and reaching for weapons.
Why are they after the boy? Silk asked.
They know that he is the only one who can touch the orb. They think that if he dies, we won't be able to get it out of Dol Hrimurgos.
What do we do?
Garion asked her, looking around helplessly.
I am going to have to concentrate on protecting the child, she told him.
Step back, Garion.
What? Get back away from me.
She bent and drew a circle in the sand, enclosing herself and the little boy in it.
Listen to me, all of you, she said. Until we are out of this, none of you come any closer to me than this. I do not want any of you getting hurt.
She drew herself up, and the white lock in her hair seemed to blaze.
Wait!
Garion exclaimed.
I don't dare. They could attack again at any moment. It is going to be up to you to protect your grandfather and the others.
Me?
You're the only one who can do it. You have the power. Use it.
She raised her hand.
How many of them are there that I have to fight off?
Garion demanded. But he already felt the sudden surge and the peculiar roaring sound in his mind as Aunt Paul's will thrust out. The air about her seemed to shimmer, distorting like heat waves on a summer afternoon. Garion could actually feel the barrier encircling her.
Aunt Paul,
he said to her.
Then he raised his voice louder and shouted, Aunt Paul!
She shook her head and pointed at her ear. She seemed to say something, but no sound penetrated the shimmering shield she had erected.
How many?
Garion mouthed the words exaggeratedly. She held up both hands with one thumb folded in.
Nine?
He mouthed again. She nodded, and then drew her cloak in around the little boy.
Well, Garion?
Silk asked then, his eyes penetrating.
What do we do now?
Why are you asking me?
You heard her. Belgarath's still in the daze, and she is busy. You are in charge now.
Me?
What do we do? Silk pressed. You've got to learn to make decisions.
I don't know, Garion floundered helplessly.
Never admit that, Silk told him. Act as if you know, even if you don't.
We'll wait until it gets dark, I guess. Then we'll keep going the same way we have been.
There, Silk grinned. See how easy it is.
Chapter 3 There was the faintest sliver of a moon low over the horizon as they started out across the black sand of the wasteland in the biting chill. Garion felt distinctly uncomfortable in the role Silk had thrust upon him. He knew that there had been no need for it, since they all knew where they were going and what they had to do. If any kind of leadership had actually been required, Silk himself was the logical one to provide it. But instead, the little man had placed the burden squarely on Garion's shoulders, and now seemed to be watching intently to see how he would handle it. There was no time for leadership, or even discussion, when, shortly after midnight, they ran into a party of Murgos. There were six of them. And they came galloping over a low ridge to the south and blundered directly into the middle of Garion's party. Barak and Mandaralan reacted with that instant violence of trained warriors, their swords whistling out of their sheaths to crunch with steely, ringing sounds into the mail-shirted bodies of the startled Murgos. Even as Garion struggled to draw his own sword, he saw one of the black-robed intruders tumble limply out of his saddle, while another, howling with pain and surprise, toppled slowly backward, clutching at his chest. There was a confusion of shouts and shrill screams from terrified horses as the men fought in the darkness. One frightened Murgo wheeled his mount to flee, but Garion, without even thinking, pulled his horse in front of him, sword raised to strike. The desperate Murgo made a frantic swing with his own weapon, but Garion easily parried the badly aimed swipe and flicked his blade lightly, whip-like, across the Murgo's shoulder. There was a satisfying crunch as the sharp edge bit into the Murgo's mail shirt. Garion deftly parried another clumsy swing and whipped his blade again, slashing the Murgo across the face. All the instruction he had received from his friends seemed to click together into a single unified style that was part Garrick, part Arendish, part Elgar, and was distinctly Geryon's own. The style baffled the frightened Murgo, and his efforts became more desperate. But each time he swung, Geryon easily parried, and instantly countered with those light, flicking slashes that inevitably drew blood. Geryon felt a wild, surging exultation boiling in his veins as he fought, and there was a fiery taste in his mouth. Then Relg darted in out of the shadows, jerked the Murgo off balance, and drove his hook-pointed knife up under the man's ribs. The Murgo doubled over sharply, shuddered, then fell dead from his saddle.
"What did you do that for?"
Geryon demanded without thinking.
"That was my Murgo."
Marak, surveying the carnage, laughed, his sudden mirth startling in the darkness.
"He's turning savage on us, isn't he?"
"His skill is noteworthy, however," Mandarallan replied approvingly.
Geryon's spirits soared. He looked around eagerly for someone else to fight, but the Murgos were all dead.
"Were they alone?"
he demanded, somewhat out of breath.
"I mean, were there any others coming along behind them? Maybe we should go look."
"We do want them to find our trail, after all," Silk reminded him. "It is up to you, of course, Geryon. But if we exterminate all of the Murgos in the area, there won't be anyone left to report our direction back to Rakthol, will there?"
"Oh," Geryon said, feeling a little sheepish. "I forgot about that."
"You have to keep the grand plan in view, Geryon, and not lose sight of it during these little side adventures."
"Maybe I got carried away."
"A good leader cannot afford to do that."
"All right."
Geryon began to feel embarrassed.
"I just wanted to be sure that you understood, that is all."
Geryon did not answer. But he began to see what it was about Silk that irritated Belgarath so much. Leadership was enough of a burden without these continual sly comments from the weasel-faced little man to complicate things.
"Are you all right?"
Tyba was saying to Relg, with a strange note of concern in her voice. The Ulgo was still on his knees beside the body of the Murgo he had killed.
"Leave me alone," he told her harshly.
"Don't be so stupid. Are you hurt? Let me see."
"Don't touch me."
He cringed away from her outstretched hand.
"Belgarion, make her get away from me."
Geryon groaned inwardly.
"What's the trouble now?"
he asked.
"I killed this man," Relg replied. "There are certain things I have to do. Certain prayers, purification. She's interfering."
Geryon resisted an impulse to swear.
"Please, Tyba," he said as calmly as he could. "Just leave him alone." "I just wanted to see if he was all right,"
Tyba answered a bit petulantly.
"I wasn't hurting him."
She had an odd look on her face that Geryon could not begin to understand. As she stared at the kneeling Ulgo, a curious little smile flickered across her lips. Without warning, she reached her hand out toward him again. Relg shrank back.
"No,"
he gasped. Tyba chuckled a throaty, wicked little sound, and walked away, humming softly to herself. After Relg had performed his ritual of purification over the dead Murgo's body, they remounted and rode on. The sliver of moon stood high overhead in the chill sky, casting a pale light down on the black sands, and Geryon looked about constantly as he rode, trying to pick out any possible dangers lurking ahead. He glanced frequently at Aunt Paul, wishing that she were not so completely cut off from him, but she seemed to be totally absorbed in maintaining her shield of will. She rode with Erand, pulled closely against her, and her eyes were distant, unfathomable. Geryon looked hopefully at Belgarath, but the old man, though he looked up from his doze at times, seemed largely unaware of his surroundings. Geryon sighed, and his eyes resumed their nervous scrutiny of the trail ahead. They rode on through the tag end of night and the biting chill, with the faint moonlight about them, and the stars glittering like points of ice in the sky above. Suddenly, Geryon heard a roaring in his mind, a sound that had a peculiar echo to it. and the shield of force surrounding Aunt Paul shimmered with an ugly orange glow. He jerked his will in sharply and gestured with a single word. He had no idea what word he used, but it seemed to work. Like a horse blundering into a covey of feeding birds, his will scattered the concerted attack on Aunt Paul and Erend. There had been more than one mind involved in the attack. He sensed that. But it seemed to make no difference. He caught a momentary flicker of chagrin, and even fear, as the joined wills of Aunt Paul's attackers broke and fled from him.
"Not bad," the voice in his mind observed. "A little clumsy, perhaps, but not bad at all."
"It's the first time I ever did it," Geryon replied. "I'll get better with more practice."
"Don't get overconfident," the voice advised dryly. And then it was gone.
He was growing stronger. There was no doubt about that. The ease with which he had dispersed the combined wills of that group of Grolems, Aunt Paul had called the Hierarchs, amazed him. He faintly began to understand what Aunt Paul and Belgareth meant in their use of the word talent. There seemed to be some kind of capacity, a limit beyond which most sorcerers could not go. Geryon realized with a certain surprise that he was already stronger than men who had been practicing this art for centuries, and that he was only beginning to touch the edges of his talent. The thought of what he might eventually be able to do was more than a little frightening. It did, however, make him feel somewhat more secure. He straightened in his saddle and rode a bit more confidently. Perhaps leadership was not so bad after all. It took some getting used to, but once you knew what you were doing, it didn't seem all that hard. The next attack came as the eastern horizon had begun to grow pale behind them. Aunt Paul, her horse, and the little boy all seemed to vanish as absolute blackness engulfed them. Geryon struck back instantly, and he added a contemptuous little twist to it, a stinging slap at the joined minds that had mounted the attack. He felt a glow of self-satisfaction at the surprise and pain in the minds as they flinched back from his quick counterblow. There was a glimpse, just a momentary one, of 9 very old men in black robes seated around a table in a room somewhere. One of the walls of the room had a large crack in it, and part of the ceiling had collapsed as a result of the earthquake that had convulsed Rachthal. 8 of the evil old men looked surprised and frightened. The 9th one had fainted. The darkness surrounding Aunt Paul disappeared.
"What are they doing?" Silk asked him.
"They are trying to break through Aunt Paul's shield," Geryon replied. "I gave them something to think about."
He felt a little smug about it. Silk looked at him, his eyes narrowed shrewdly.
"Don't overdo things, Geryon," he advised.
"Somebody had to do something," Geryon protested.
"That is usually the way it works out. All I am saying is that you should not lose your perspective."
The broken wall of peaks that marked the western edge of the wasteland was clearly visible as the light began to creep up the eastern sky.
"How far would you say it is?" Geryon asked Durnick.
The smith squinted at the mountains ahead.
2, maybe 3 leagues at least," he judged. "Distances are deceiving in this kind of light."
"Well," Barak asked, "do we take cover for the day here, or do we make a run for it?"
Geryon thought about that.
"Are we going to change direction as soon as we get to the mountains?"
he asked Mandarallan.
"'Twould seem better, mayhap, to continue our present course for some little distance at first," the knight replied thoughtfully. "A natural boundary such as that which lies ahead might attract more than passing scrutiny."
"That is a good point," Silk agreed.
Geryon scratched at his cheek, noticing that his whiskers had begun to sprout again.
"Maybe we should stop here, then," he suggested. "We could start out again when the sun goes down, get up into the mountains away, and then rest. When the sun comes up tomorrow morning, we can change our route. That way we'll have light enough to see any tracks we leave and cover them up."
"Seems like a good plan," Barak approved.
"Well, let's do it that way then," Geryon decided.
They sought out another ridge and another ravine, and once again concealed it with their tent canvas. Although he was tired, Geryon was reluctant to lose himself in sleep. Not only did the cares of leadership press heavily on him, but he also felt apprehensive about the possibility of an attack by the hierarchs coming while he was asleep. As the others began to unroll their blankets, he walked about rather aimlessly, stopping to look at Aunt Paul, who sat with her back against a large rock, holding the sleeping errand and looking as distant as the moon behind her shimmering shield. Geryon sighed and went on down to the mouth of the ravine where Durnik was attending to their horses. It had occurred to him that all of their lives depended on the well-being of their mounts, and that gave him something else to worry about.
"How are they?"
he asked Durnik as he approached.
"Better not fairly well," Durnik replied. "They've come a long way, though. It's beginning to show on some of them."
"Is there anything that we can do for them?"
"A week's rest in a good pasture, perhaps," Durnik answered with a wry smile.
Geryon laughed. "I think we could all use a week's rest in a good pasture."
"You've really grown, Geryon,"
Durnik observed, as he lifted another horse's hind hoof to examine it for cuts or bruises. Geryon glanced at his arm and saw that his wrist stuck an inch or two out of his sleeve.
"Most of my clothes still fit, pretty much."
"Oh, that's not the way I meant," Durnik hesitated. "What's it like, Geryon, being able to do things the way you do?"
"It scares me, Durnik," Geryon admitted quietly. "I didn't really want any of this, but it didn't give me any choice."
"You mustn't let it frighten you, you know," Durnik said carefully, lowering the horse's hoof. "If it's part of you." "It's part of you, just like being tall or having blonde hair."
"It's not really like that, Durnik. Being tall or having blonde hair doesn't hurt anybody. This can."
Durnik looked out at the long shadows of the ridge stretching away from the newly risen sun.
"You just have to learn to be careful with it, that's all. But I was about your age. I found out that I was much stronger than the other young men in our village, probably because I worked in the smithy. I didn't want to hurt anybody, so I wouldn't wrestle with my friends. One of them thought I was a coward because of that. Pushed me around for about 6 months. Till I finally lost my temper."
"Did you fight him?"
Durnik nodded.
"'Twasn't really much of a contest. After it was over, he realized that I wasn't a coward at all. We even got to be good friends again, after his bones all healed up, and he got used to the missing teeth."
Geryon grinned at him, and Durnik smiled back a bit ruefully.
"I was ashamed of myself afterward, of course."
Geryon felt very close to this plain, solid man. Durnik was his oldest friend, somebody he could always count on.
"But I'm trying to say, Geryon," Durnik continued seriously, "is that you can't go through life being afraid of what you are. If you do that, sooner or later somebody will come along who'll misunderstand you, and you'll have to do something to show them that it's not him that you're afraid of. When it goes that far, it's usually much worse for you. And for him, too."
"The way it was with Asherak?"
Durnik nodded.
"It's always best in the long run to be what you are. 'Tisn't proper to behave as if you're more, but 'tisn't good to behave as if you were less, either. Do you understand what I'm trying to say?"
"The whole problem seems to be finding out just exactly what you really are,"
Geryon observed.
Durnik smiled again. "That's a part that gets most of us in trouble at times."
Suddenly the smile fell away from his face, and he gasped. Then he fell writhing to the ground, clutching at his stomach.
"Durnik!" Geryon cried. "What's wrong?"
But Durnik could not answer. His face was ashen and contorted with agony as he twisted in the dirt. Geryon felt a strange alien pressure, and he understood instantly. Thwarted in their attempts to kill Erend, the hierarchs were directing their attacks at others in the hope of forcing Aunt Paul to drop her shield. A terrible rage boiled up in him. His blood seemed to burn, and a fierce cry came to his lips.
Calmly. It was the voice within his mind again. What do I do?
Get out into the sunlight.
Geryon did not understand that, but he ran out past the horses into the pale morning light.
Put yourself into your shadow.
He looked down at the shadow stretching out on the ground in front of him, and obeyed the voice. He wasn't sure exactly how he did it, but he poured his will and his awareness into the shadow.
Now, follow the trail of their thought back to them. Quickly.
Geryon felt himself suddenly flying. Enclosed in his shadow, he touched the still-writhing Durnik once, like a sniffing hound, picked up the direction of the concerted thought that had felled his friend, and then flashed through the air back over the miles of wasteland toward the wreckage of Rakdhal. He had, it seemed, no weight, and there was an odd purplish cast to everything he saw. He felt his immensity as he entered the room with the cracked wall where the 9 black-robed old men sat, trying with the concerted power of their minds to kill Durnik. Their eyes were all focused on a huge ruby, nearly the size of a man's head, which lay flickering in the center of the table around which they sat. The slanting rays of the morning sun had distorted and enlarged Geryon's shadow, and he filled one corner of the room, bending slightly, so that he could fit under the ceiling.
Stop! He roared at the evil old men. Leave Durnik alone!
They flinched back from his sudden apparition, and he could feel the thought they were directing at Durnik through the stone on the table falter and begin to fall apart. He took a threatening step and saw them cringe away from him in the purple light that half clouded his vision. Then one of the old men, very thin and with a long, dirty beard and completely hairless scalp, seemed to recover from his momentary fright.
"Stand firm," he snapped at the others. "Keep the thought on the Sindar."
"Leave him alone," Geryon shouted at them.
"Who says so?"
the thin old man drawled insultingly.
"I do." "And just who are you?"
"I am Belgarion. Leave my friends alone." The old man laughed, and his laugh was as chilling as Tuchuk's had been.
"Actually, you're only Belgarion's shadow," he corrected. "We know the trick of the shadow. You can talk, bluster, and threaten, but that's all you can do. You're just as powerless as a shade, Belgarion."
"Leave us alone."
"And what will you do if we do not?"
The old man's face was filled with contemptuous amusement.
"Is he right?"
Geryon demanded of the voice within his mind. "Perhaps. Perhaps not," the voice replied. "A few men have been able to go beyond the limitation. You won't know unless you try."
Despite his dreadful anger, Geryon did not want to kill any of them.
"Ice," he said, focusing on the idea of cold and lashing out with his will. It felt odd, almost tenuous, as if it had no substance behind it, and the roaring was hollow and puny-sounding. The bald old man sneered and waggled his beard insultingly. Geryon ground his insubstantial teeth and drew himself in with dreadful concentration.
"Burn,"
he said then, driving his will. There was a flicker, then a sudden flash. The force of Geryon's will burst forth, directed not at the bald man himself, but rather at his whiskers.
The hierarch jumped up and stumbled back with a hoarse exclamation, trying desperately to beat the flames out of his beard. The concerted thought of the hierarch shattered as the rest of them scrambled to their feet in terrified astonishment. Grimly, Geryon gathered his swelling will and began to lay about him with his immensely long arms. He tumbled the hierarchs across the rough stone floor and slammed them into walls. Squealing with fright, they scurried this way and that, trying to escape, but he methodically reached out and grasped them one by one to administer his chastisement. With a peculiar kind of detachment, he even stuffed one of them headfirst into the crack in the wall, pushing quite firmly until only a pair of wriggling feet were sticking out. Then, when it was done, he turned back to the bald hierarch who had managed finally to beat the last of the fire out of his beard.
"It is impossible! Impossible!"
the hierarch protested, his face stunned.
How did you do it?
I told you. I am Belgarian. I can do things you cannot even imagine.
The jewel, the voice told him. They're using the jewel to focus their attacks. Destroy it.
How?
It can only hold so much.
Look. Garion suddenly found that he could actually see into the interior of the still flickering ruby on the table. He saw the minute stress lines within its crystalline structure. Then he understood. He turned his will upon it and poured all of his anger into it. The stone blazed with light and began to pulsate as the force within it swelled. Then, with a sharp detonation, the stone exploded into fragments.
No!
The bald hierarch wailed.
You idiot! That stone was irreplaceable!
Listen to me, old man, Garion said in an awful voice. You will leave us alone. You will not pursue us, or try to injure any of us any more.
He reached out with his shadowy hand and slid it directly into the bald man's chest. He could feel the heart flutter like a terrified bird, and the lungs falter as the hierarch's breath stopped, and he gaped with horror at the arm sticking out of his chest. Garion slowly opened his fingers very wide.
Do you understand me? He demanded. The hierarch gurgled and tried to take hold of the arm, but his fingers found nothing to grasp.
Do you understand me?
Garion repeated, and suddenly clenched his fist. The hierarch screamed.
Are you going to leave us alone? Please, Belgarion, no more. I am dying.
Are you going to leave us alone? Garion demanded again.
Yes, anything. But please stop. I beg you. I will do anything. Please.
Garion unclenched his fist and drew his hand out of the hierarch's heaving chest. He held it up, claw-like, directly in front of the old man's face.
Look at this. Remember it,
he said in a dreadfully quiet voice.
Next time, I'll reach into your chest and pull your heart out.
The hierarch shrank back, his eyes filled with horror, as he stared at that awful hand.
I promise you, he stammered. I promise.
Your life depends on it, Garion told him, then turned and flashed back across the empty miles toward his friends. Quite suddenly, he was standing at the mouth of the ravine, staring down at his shadow, slowly reforming on the ground before him. The purple haze was gone. Strangely enough, he didn't even feel tired. Durnick drew in a shuddering breath and struggled to rise. Garion turned quickly and ran back to his friend.
Are you all right?
He asked, taking hold of the smith's arm.
It was like a knife twisting inside me,
Durnick replied in a shaking voice.
What was it?
The Grolem hierarchs were trying to kill you,
Garion told him. Durnick looked around, his eyes frightened.
Don't worry, Durnick. They won't do it again.
Garion helped him to his feet, and together they went back into the ravine. Aunt Paul was looking directly at him as he approached her. Her eyes were penetrating.
You're growing up very fast, she said to him.
I had to do something, he replied. What happened to your shield?
It doesn't seem to be necessary anymore.
Not bad,
Belgarath said. The old man was sitting up. He looked weak and drawn, but his eyes were alert.
Some of it was a bit exotic, but on the whole it wasn't bad at all. The business with the hand was just a little overdone, though.
I wanted to be sure he understood that I meant what I was saying.
Garion felt a tremendous wave of relief at his grandfather's return to consciousness.
I think you convinced him, Belgarath said dryly. Is there anything to eat somewhere nearby?
He asked Aunt Paul.
Are you all right now, grandfather?
Garion asked him.
Aside from being as weak as a fresh-hatched baby chick and as hungry as a she-wolf with 9 puppies, I'm just fine, Belgarath replied. I could really use something to eat, Bogara.
I'll see what I can find, father, she told him, turning to the packs.
I don't know that you need to bother cooking it, he added.
The little boy had been looking curiously at Geryon, his wide blue eyes serious and slightly puzzled. Quite suddenly he laughed, smiling. He looked into Garion's face.
Bulgarian, he said.
Chapter 4
No regrets? Silk asked Geryon that evening as they rode toward the sharply rising peaks outlined against the glittering stars ahead.
Regrets about what?
Giving up command.
Silk had been watching him curiously, ever since the setting sun had signaled the resumption of their journey.
No,
Geryon replied, not quite sure what the little man meant.
Why should there be?
It's a very important thing for a man to learn about himself, Geryon,
Silk told him seriously.
Power can be very sweet for some men, and you never know how a man's going to handle it until you give him the chance to try.
I don't know why you went to all the trouble. It's not too likely that I'm going to be put in charge of things very often.
Oh, you never know, Geryon. You never know.
They rode on across the barren black sands of the wasteland toward the mountains looming ahead. The quarter moon rose behind them, and its light was cold and white. Near the edge of the wasteland there were a few scrubby thorn bushes huddling low to the sand and silvered with frost. It was an hour or so before midnight when they finally reached rocky ground, and the hoofs of the horses clattered sharply as they climbed up out of the sandy waste. When they topped the first ridge, they stopped to look back. The dark expanse of the wasteland behind them was dotted with the watchfires of the Murgos, and far back along their trail they saw moving torches.
I was starting to worry about that, Silk said to Belgareth. But it looks as if they have found our trail after all.
Let's hope they don't lose it again, the old man replied.
Oh, not too likely, really. I made it pretty obvious.
Murgos can be a bit undependable sometimes.
Belgareth seemed to have recovered almost completely, but Geryon noted a weary slump to his shoulders and was glad that they did not plan to ride all night. The mountains into which they rode were arid and rocky as the ones lying to the north. There were looming cliffs and patches of alkali on the ground and a bitingly cold wind that seemed to wail endlessly through the rocks and to tug at the coarse-woven Murgo robes that disguised them. They pushed on until they were well into the mountains. Then, several hours before dawn, they stopped to rest and to wait for the sun to rise. When the first faint light appeared on the eastern horizon, Silk rode out and located a rocky gap passing to the northwest between two ochreous cliff faces. As soon as he returned, they saddled their horses again and moved out at a trot.
"We can get rid of these now, I think,"
Belgareth said, pulling off his Murgo robe.
"I'll take them," Silk suggested as he reined in. "The gap's just ahead there," he pointed. "I'll catch up in a couple of hours."
"Where are you going?"
Barak asked him.
"I'll leave a few miles more of False Trail," Silk replied. "Then I'll double back and make sure that you haven't left any tracks. It won't take long."
"You want some company?"
Silk shook his head.
"I can move faster alone."
"Be careful,"
Silk grinned.
"I'm always careful."
He took the Murgo garments from them and rode off to the west. The gap into which they rode appeared to be the bed of a stream that had dried up thousands of years before. The water had cut down through the rock, revealing layer upon layer of red, brown, and yellow stone lying in bands, one atop of the other. The sound of their horses' hooves was very loud as they clattered along between the cliffs, and the wind whistled as it poured through the cut. Taiba drew her horse in beside Geryon's. She was shivering, and she had the cloak he had given her pulled tightly about her shoulders.
"Is it always this cold?"
she asked. Her large violet eyes were very wide. "In the wintertime, he replied.
I imagine it's pretty hot there in the summer.
The slave pens were always the same, she told him. We never knew what the season was.
The twisting stream bed made a sharp bend to the right, and they rode into the light of the newly risen sun.
Taiba gasped.
What's wrong?
Garion asked her quickly.
The light, she cried, covering her face with her hands. It is like a fire in my eyes.
Relg, who rode directly in front of them, was also shielding his eyes. He looked back over his shoulder at the Merag woman.
Here,
he said. He took one of the veils he usually bound across his eyes when they were in direct sunlight and handed it back to her.
Cover your face with this until we are back into the shadows again.
His voice was peculiarly neutral.
Thank you,
Taiba said, binding the cloth across her eyes.
I did not know that the sun could be so bright.
You'll get used to it, Relg told her. It just takes some time. Try to protect your eyes for the first few days.
He seemed about to turn and ride on, then he looked at her curiously.
Have you not ever seen the sun before?
No,
she replied.
Other slaves told me about it, though. The Murkos don't use women on their work gangs, so I was never taken out of the pins. It was always dark down there.
It must have been terrible.
Garion shuddered. She shrugged.
The dark wasn't so bad. It was the light we were afraid of. Light meant that the Murkos were coming with torches to take someone to the temple to be sacrificed.
The trail they followed turned again, and they rode out of the bright glare of the sunlight.
Thank you,
Taiba said to Relg, removing the veil from her eyes and holding it out to him.
Keep it, he told her. You will probably need it again.
His voice seemed oddly subdued, and his eyes had a strange gentleness in them. As he looked at her, the haunted expression crept back over his face. Since they had left Rakthal, Garion had covertly watched these two. He knew that Relg, despite all of his efforts, could not take his eyes off of the Merag woman he had been forced to rescue from her living entombment in the caves. Although Relg still ranted about sin continually, his words no longer carried the weight of absolute conviction. Indeed, quite often, they seemed to be little more than a mechanical repetition of a set of formula. Occasionally, Garion had noted, even those formulas had faltered when Taiba's deep violet eyes had turned to regard the Ulgo's face. For her part, Taiba was quite obviously puzzled. Relg's rejection of her simple gratitude had humiliated her, and her resentment had been hot and immediate. His constant scrutiny, however, spoke to her with a meaning altogether different from the words that came from his lips. His eyes told her one thing, but his mouth said something else. She was baffled by him, not knowing whether to respond to his look or to his words.
You have lived your whole life in the dark, then?
Relg asked her curiously.
Most of it,
she replied.
I saw my mother's face once, the day the Murkos came and took her to the temple. I was alone after that. Being alone is the worst of it. You can bear the dark if you are not alone.
How old were you when they took your mother away?
I don't really know. I must have been almost a woman, though, because not long after that the Murkos gave me to a slave who had pleased them. There were a lot of slaves in the pins who did anything the Murkos wanted, and they were rewarded with extra food, or with women. I cried at first, but in time I learned to accept it. At least I was not alone anymore.
Relg's face hardened, and Taiba saw the expression.
What should I have done?
She asked him.
When you are a slave, your body does not belong to you. They can sell you, or give you to anybody they want to. And there is nothing you can do about it.
There must have been something.
Such as what? I didn't have any kind of a weapon to fight with, or to kill myself with. And you cannot strangle yourself.
She looked at Geryon.
Did you know that? Some of the slaves tried it, but all you do is fall into unconsciousness, and then you start breathing again. Isn't that curious?
Did you try to fight?
It seemed terribly important to Relg for some reason.
What would have been the point? The slave they gave me to was stronger than I. He would have just hit me until I did what he wanted.
You should have fought, Relg declared stubbornly. A little pain is better than sin. And giving up like that is sin.
Is it? If somebody forces you to do something and there is no possible way to avoid it, is it really sin?
Relg started to answer, but her eyes, looking directly into his face, seemed to stop up his tongue. He faltered, unable to face that gaze. Abruptly, he turned his mount and rode back toward the pack animals.
Why does he fight with himself so much?
Tyba asked.
He is completely devoted to his god,
Geryon explained.
He's afraid of anything that might take away some of what he feels he owes to Ul.
Is this Ul of his really that jealous?
No, I don't think so. But Relg does.
Tyba pursed her lips into a sensual pout and looked back over her shoulder at the retreating zealot.
Do you know?
She said.
I think he is actually afraid of me.
She laughed then, that same low, wicked little laugh, and lifted her arms to run her fingers through the glory of her midnight hair.
No one has ever been afraid of me before. Not ever. I think I rather like it. Would you excuse me?
She turned her horse without waiting for a reply, and quite deliberately rode back after the fleeing Relg. Geryon thought about it as he rode on through the narrow, twisting canyon. He realized that there was a strength in Tyba that none of them had suspected, and he finally concluded that Relg was in for a very bad time. He trotted on ahead to speak to Aunt Paul about it, as she rode with her arms about Erend.
It is really none of your business, Geryon, she told him. Relg and Tyba can work out their problems without any help from you. I was just curious, that's all. Relg's tearing himself apart, and Tyba's all confused about him. What's really going on between them, Aunt Paul?
Something very necessary, she replied.
You could say that about nearly everything that happens, Aunt Paul.
It was almost an accusation.
You could even say that the way Synedra and I quarrel all the time is necessary, too, couldn't you?
She looked slightly amused.
It is not exactly the same thing, Geryon, but there's a certain necessity about that, too.
Oh, that's ridiculous, he scoffed.
Is it really? Then why do you suppose the two of you go out of your way so much to aggravate one another?
He had no answer for that, but the entire notion worried him. At the same time, the very mention of Tenedra's name suddenly brought her sharply into mind, and he realized that he actually missed her. He rode along in silence beside Aunt Paul for a while, feeling melancholy. Finally, he sighed.
And why so great a sigh?
It's all over, isn't it?
And what's that?
This whole thing. I mean, we have recovered the orb. That's what this was all about, wasn't it?
Oh, there's more to it than that, Geryon, much more. And we are not out of Thalmurgos yet, are we?
You're not really worried about that, are you?
But then, as if her question had suddenly uncovered some lingering doubts in his own mind, he stared at her in sudden apprehension.
What would happen if we didn't?
He blurted.
If we didn't make it out, I mean. What would happen to the West if we didn't get the orb back to Riva? Things would become unpleasant. There would be a war, wouldn't there? And the Angoraks would win, and there'd be Grolems everywhere with their knives and their altars.
The thought of Grolems marching up to the gates of Faldor's farm outraged him.
Oh, don't go borrowing trouble, Geryon. Let us worry about one thing at a time, shall we? But what if...
Geryon, she said with a pained look.
Don't belabor the what-ifs, please. If you start that, you'll just worry everyone to death. Well, you say what-if to Grandfather all of the time. That is different, she replied.
They rode hard for the next several days through a series of passes with the dry, bitter chill pressing at them like some great weight. Silk rode back often to look for any signs of pursuit, but their ruse seemed to have fooled the Mervos. Finally, about noon on a cold, sunless day, when the wind was kicking up dust clouds along the horizon, they reached the broad, arid valley through which the south caravan route wound. They took cover behind a low hill, while Silk rode on ahead to take a quick look.
"Thinkest thou that Tower Uros hath joined in the search for us?"
Mandarallan, dressed again in his armor, asked Belgarath.
"'It's hard to say for sure,' the old sorcerer replied. "'He's a very unpredictable man.'
"'There's a Mogo patrol headed east on the caravan route,' Silk reported when he returned. "'It will be another half hour or so until they are out of sight.'
Belgarath nodded.
"'You think we'll be safe once we cross over into Mishrak-Akhtul?'
Durnek asked.
"'We cannot count on it,' Belgarath replied. "'Gethel, king of the Tulls, is afraid of Tower Urgas, so he would not make any kind of a fuss about a border violation if Tower Urgas decided to follow us.'
They waited until the Mergos had crossed a low ridge to the east, and then moved out again. For the next 2 days, they rode steadily to the northwest. The terrain grew less rocky after they crossed into the land of the Tulls, and they saw the telltale dust clouds far behind them that spoke of mounted Mergo search parties. It was late in the afternoon of a murky day when they finally reached the top of the eastern escarpment. Barak glanced back over his shoulder at the dust clouds behind them, then pulled his horse in beside Belgarath's.
"'Just how rough is the ground leading down into the vale? It is not the easiest trail in the world. Those Mergos are less than a day behind us, Belgarath. If we have to pick our way down, they will be on top of us before we can make it.'
Belgarath pursed his lips, squinting at the dust clouds on the southern horizon.
"'Perhaps you're right. Maybe we had better think this through.'
He raised his hand to call a halt.
"'It is time to make a couple of decisions,' he told the rest of them. "'The Mergos are a little closer than we really want them to be. It takes 2 to 3 days to make the descent into the vale.' And there are places where one definitely does not want to be rushed.
We could always go on to that ravine we followed coming up, Silk suggested. It only takes a half day to go down that way.
But Lord Hethar and the Elgar clans of King Kohag await us in the vale, Mandarallan objected. Were we to go on, would we not lead the Mergos down into undefended country?
"'Have we got any choice?'
Silk asked him.
"'We could light fires along the way. Hetar will know what they mean,'
Barak suggested.
"'So would the Mergos,' Silk said. "'They would ride all night and be right behind us every step of the way down.'
Belgarath scratched sourly at his short white beard.
"'I think we are going to have to abandon the original plan.' We have to take the shortest way down, and that means the ravine, I'm afraid. We will be on our own once we get down, but that cannot be helped. Surely King Kohag will have scouts posted along the foot of the escarpment, Dernick said, his plain face worried.
We can hope so, Barak replied.
All right, then, Belgareth said firmly. We use the ravine. I do not altogether like the idea, but our options seem to have been narrowed a bit. Let's ride.
It was late afternoon when they reached the shallow gully at the top of the steep notch leading down to the plain below. Belgareth glanced once down the precipitous cut and shook his head.
Not in the dark, he decided. Can you see any signs of the Algars? He asked Barak, who was staring out at the plain below.
I'm afraid not, the red-bearded man answered. Do you want to light a fire to signal them?
No, the old man replied. Let's not announce our intentions.
I will need a small fire, though, Aunt Paul told him. We all need a hot meal.
I don't know if that's wise, Mulgara, Belgareth objected. We'll have a hard day tomorrow, Father, she said firmly.
Jernick knows how to build a small fire and to keep it hidden.
Oh, have it your way, Paul, the old man said in a resigned tone of voice.
Naturally, Father.
It was cold that night, and they kept their fire small and well sheltered. As the first light of dawn began to stain the cloudy sky to the east, they rose and prepared to descend the rocky cut toward the plain below.
I'll strike the tents, Dernick said. You just knock them down, Belgareth told him.
He turned and nudged one of the packs thoughtfully with his foot.
We take only what we absolutely have to. We're not going to have the time to waste on these. But you're not just going to leave them, Dernick sounded shocked. They will just be in the way, and the horses will be able to move faster without them. But, well, they're all our belongings, Dernick protested.
Silk also looked a bit chagrined. He quickly spread out a blanket and began rummaging through the packs, his quick hands bringing out innumerable small valuable items and piling them in a heap on the blanket.
Where did you get all of those? Barak asked him.
Oh, here and there, Silk said evasively.
You stole them, didn't you?
Oh, some of them, Silk admitted.
We have been on the roads for a long time, Barak.
Do you really plan to carry all of that down this ravine?
Barak asked, curiously eyeing Silk's treasures. Silk looked at the heap, mentally weighing it, and then he sighed with profound regret.
No, I guess not.
He stood up and scattered the heap with his foot.
It is all very pretty, though, isn't it?
Now I guess I'll have to start all over again.
He grinned then.
It's the stealing that's fun, anyway. Let's go down.
And he started toward the top of the steeply descending stream bed that angled sharply down toward the base of the escarpment. The unburdened horses were able to move much more rapidly, and they all passed quite easily over spots Geryon remembered painfully from the upward climb weeks before. By noon, they were more than halfway down. Then Polgara stopped and raised her face.
Father, she said calmly, they have found the top of the ravine.
How many of them?
It's an advance patrol. No more than 20.
Far above them, they heard the sharp clash of rock against rock, and then after a moment, another.
I was afraid of that, Belgareth said sourly.
What?
Geryon asked. They're rolling rocks down on us. The old man grimly hitched up his belt. All right. The rest of you go on ahead. Get down as fast as you can.
Are you strong enough, Father?
Aunt Paul asked, sounding concerned.
You still have not really recovered, you know.
And we're about to find out, the old man replied, his face set. Move, all of you.
He said it in a tone that cut off any possible argument. As they all began scrambling down over the steep rocks, Geryon lagged farther and farther behind. Finally, As Durnick led the last pack horse over a jumble of broken stone and around a bend, Garion stopped entirely and stood listening. He could hear the clatter and slide of hooves on the rocks below, and from above, the clash and bounce of a large stone tumbling over the ravine, coming closer and closer. Then there was a familiar surge and roaring sound. A rock, somewhat larger than a man's head, went whistling over him, angling sharply up out of the cut to fall harmlessly far out on the tumbled debris at the floor of the escarpment. Carefully, Garion began climbing back up the ravine, pausing often to listen. Belgorath was sweating as Garion came into sight around a bend in the ravine a goodly way above and ducked back out of the old man's sight. Another rock, somewhat larger than the first, came bounding and crashing down the narrow ravine, bouncing off the walls and leaping into the air each time it struck the rocky stream bed. About 20 yards above Belgorath, it struck solidly and spun into the air. The old man gestured irritably, grunting with the effort, and the rock sailed out in a long arc, clearing the walls of the ravine and falling out of sight. Garion quickly crossed the stream bed and went down several yards more, staying close against the rocky wall and peering back to be sure he was concealed from his grandfather. When the next rock came bouncing and clashing down toward them, Garion gathered his will. He'd have to time it perfectly, he knew, and he peered around a corner, watching the old man intently. When Belgorath raised his hand, Garion pushed his own will in to join his grandfather's, hoping to slip a bit of unnoticed help to him. Belgorath watched the rock go whirling far out over the plain below. Then he turned and looked sternly down the ravine.
"All right, Garion," he said crisply. "Step out where I can see you."
Somewhat sheepishly, Garion went out into the center of the stream bed and stood looking up at his grandfather.
"Why is it that you can never do what you are told to do?" the old man demanded.
"I just thought I could help, that's all."
"Did I ask for help? Do I look like an invalid?"
"There's another rock coming."
"Don't change the subject. I think you're getting above yourself, young man."
"Grandfather,"
Garion said urgently, staring at the large rock bounding down the ravine directly for the old man's back. He threw his will under the rock and hurled it out of the ravine. Belgorath looked up at the stone soaring over his head.
"Tacky, Garion," he said disapprovingly. "Very tacky. You don't have to throw them all the way to Prolgu, you know. Stop trying to show off."
"I got excited," Garion apologized. "I pushed a little too hard,"
the old man grunted. "All right," he said a bit ungraciously. "As long as you're here anyway. But stick to your own rocks. I can manage mine, and you throw me off balance when you come blundering in like that."
"I just need a little practice, that's all."
"You need some instruction in etiquette, too," Belgorath told him, coming on down to where Garion stood. "You don't just jump in with help until you are asked. That's very bad form, Garion."
"Another rock is coming,"
Garion informed him politely.
"Do you want to get it, or shall I?"
"Don't get snippy, young man," Belgorath told him, then turned and flipped the approaching rock out of the ravine.
They moved on down together, taking turns on the rocks the Murgos were rolling down the ravine. Garion discovered that it grew easier each time he did it, but Belgorath was drenched with sweat by the time they neared the bottom. Garion considered trying once again to slip his grandfather a bit of assistance, but the old sorcerer glared at him so fiercely as he started to gather in his will that he quickly abandoned the idea.
"I wondered where you had gone,"
Aunt Paul said to Garion, as the two clambered out over the rocks at the mouth of the ravine to rejoin the rest of the party. She looked closely at Belgorath.
"Are you all right?"
"I'm just fine," he snapped. "I had all this assistance. Unsolicited, of course." He glared at Garion again. "When we get a bit of time, we are going to have to give him some lessons in controlling the noise. He sounds like a thunderclap. For some reason, the old man was behaving as if he had just been dreadfully insulted. That's not all he has to learn to control.
What now? Barak asked. Do you want to light signal fires and wait here for Hetar and Korhag?
This isn't a good place, Barak, Silk pointed out. Half of Murgodom's going to come pouring down that ravine very shortly.
The passage is not wide, Prince Keldar, Mandorallan observed. My lord Barak and I can hold it for a week or more, if need be.
You're backsliding again, Mandorallan, Barak told him.
Besides, they'd just roll rocks down on you, Silk said, and they are going to be dropping boulders off the edge up there before long. We are probably going to have to get out on the plain a ways to avoid that sort of thing.
Durnik was staring thoughtfully at the mouth of the ravine.
We need to send something up there to slow them down, though, he mused. I don't think we want them right behind us.
It's a little hard to make the rocks roll uphill, Barak said.
I wasn't thinking of the rocks, Durnik replied. We need something much lighter.
Like what? Silk asked the smith.
Smoke. Smoke's good, Durnik answered. The ravine should draw just like a chimney. If we build a fire and fill the whole thing with smoke, nobody's going to come down till the fire goes out.
Silk grinned broadly. Durnik, you're a treasure. Chapter 5.
There were bushes, scrub, and bramble, for the most part, growing here and there along the base of the cliff. And they quickly fanned out with their swords together enough to build a large, smoky fire.
You had better hurry, Belgarath told them as they worked. There are a dozen Murgos or more already halfway down the ravine.
Durnik, who had been gathering dry sticks and splintered bits of log, ran back to the mouth of the ravine, knelt, and began striking sparks from his flint into the tinder he always carried. In a few moments he had a small fire going, the orange flames licking up around the weathered gray sticks. Carefully he added larger pieces until his fire was a respectable blaze. Then he began piling thorn bushes and brambles on top of it, critically watching the direction of the smoke. The bushes hissed and smoldered fitfully at first, and a great cloud of smoke wafted this way and that for a moment, then began to pour steadily up the ravine. Durnik nodded with satisfaction.
Just like a chimney, he observed.
From far up the cut came shouts of alarm, and a great deal of coughing and choking.
How long can a man breathe smoke before he chokes to death? Silk asked.
Not very long, Durnik replied.
I didn't think so. The little man looked happily at the smoking blaze. Good fire, he said, holding his hands out to the warmth.
The smoke's going to delay them, but I think it is time to move on out, Belgarath said, squinting at the cloud-obscured ball of the sun hanging low over the horizon to the west. We'll move on up the face of the escarpment, and then make a run for it. We want to surprise them a bit, to give us time to get out of range before they can start throwing rocks down on us.
Is there any sign of Hetar out there?
Barak asked, peering out at the grassland.
We haven't seen any yet, Durnik replied.
You do know that we are going to lead half of Thal Murgos out onto that plain, Barak pointed out to Belgarath.
It cannot be helped. For right now, we have got to get out of here. If Tarugash is up there, he's going to send people after us, even if he has to throw them off the cliff personally. Let's go.
They followed the face of the cliff for a mile or more until they found a spot where the rockfall did not extend out so far onto the plain.
This will do, Belgarath decided. As soon as we get to level ground, we ride hard and straight out. An arrow shot off the top of that cliff will carry a long way. Is everybody ready?
He looked around at them.
Let's move, then.
They led their horses down the short, steep slope of rock to the grassy plain below, mounted quickly, and set off at a dead run.
arrow, Silk said sharply, looking up and back over his shoulder. Geryon, without thinking, slashed with his will at the tiny speck arcing down toward them. In the same instant, he felt a peculiar double surge coming from either side of him. The arrow broke into several pieces in midair.
"If you two don't mind," Belgareth said irritably to Geryon and Aunt Paul, half reining in his horse.
"I just didn't want you to tire yourself, Father," Aunt Paul replied. "I am sure that Geryon feels the same way."
"Could we not discuss this later?" Silk suggested, looking apprehensively back at the towering escarpment. They plunged on, the long brown grass whipping at the legs of their horses. Other arrows began to fall, dropping farther and farther behind them as they rode. By the time they were half a mile out from the sheer face, the arrows were sheeting down from the top of the cliff in a whistling black rain.
"Persistent, aren't they?" Silk observed. "It's a racial trait," Barak replied. "Murgles are stubborn to the point of idiocy." "Keep going," Belgareth told them. "It is just a question of time until they bring up a catapult."
"They're throwing ropes down the face of that cliff," Durnick reported, peering back at the escarpment.
"As soon as a few of them get to the bottom, they'll pull the fire clear of the ravine and start bringing the horses down." "At least it slowed them down a bit," Belgareth said.
Twilight, hardly more than a gradual darkening of the cloudy murk that had obscured the sky for several days, began to creep across the Algarian plain. They rode on. Geryon glanced back several times as he rode and noticed moving pinpoints of light along the base of the cliff.
"Some of them have reached the bottom, Grandfather,"
he called to the old man, who was pounding along in the lead.
"I can see their torches."
"It was bound to happen," the sorcerer replied.
It was nearly midnight by the time they reached the Aldor River, lying black and oily-looking between its frosty banks.
"Does anybody have any idea how we're going to find that ford in the dark?" Durnick asked. "I'll find it," Relg told him. "It isn't all that dark from me. Wait here."
"That could give us a certain advantage," Sulk noted. "We'll be able to ford the river, but the Murgos will flounder around on this side in the dark for half of the night. We will be leagues ahead of them before they get across."
"That was one of the things I was sort of counting on," Belgareth replied smugly.
It was a half an hour later before Relg returned.
"It isn't far," he told them.
They remounted and rode through the chill darkness, following the curve of the riverbank until they heard the unmistakable gurgle and wash of water running over the stones.
"That's it, just ahead," Relg said. "It's still going to be dangerous fording it in the dark," Barak pointed out. "It isn't that dark," Relg said. "Just follow me."
He rode confidently 100 yards farther upriver, then turned and nudged his horse into the shallow, rippling water. Geryon felt his horse flinch from the icy chill as he rode out into the river, following closely behind Belgareth. Behind him he heard Durnick coaxing the now unburdened pack animals into the water. The river was not deep, but it was very wide, almost a half mile, and in the process of fording, they were all soaked to the knees.
"The rest of the night promises to be moderately unpleasant," Silk observed, shaking one sodden foot.
"At least you've got the river between you and Taurogas," Barak reminded him.
"Oh, that does brighten things up a bit," Silk admitted. They had not gone a half mile, however, before Mandorallan's charger went down with a squeal of agony. The knight, with a great clatter, tumbled into the grass as he was pitched out of the saddle. His great horse floundered with threshing legs, trying futilely to rise.
"What's the matter with him?" Barak demanded sharply.
Behind him, with another squeal, one of the pack horses collapsed.
"What is it?"
Geryon asked Durnick, his voice shrill.
"It's the cold," Durnick answered, swinging down from his saddle. "We've ridden them to exhaustion. Then we made them wade across that river. Chills settled into their muscles."
So what do we do?
We've got to rub them down, all of them, with wool.
We don't have time for that, Silk objected.
Well, it's that or walk,
Durnick declared, pulling off his stout wool cloak and beginning to rub vigorously at his horse's legs.
Maybe we should build a fire,
Garion suggested, also dismounting and beginning to rub down his horse's shivering legs.
There isn't anything round here to burn, Durnick told him. This is our open grassland.
And the fire would set up a beacon for every Murgle within 10 miles,
Barak added, massaging the legs of his gray horse. They all worked as rapidly as possible, but the sky to the east had begun to pale with the first hints of dawn before Mandor Allen's horse was on his feet again and the rest of their mounts were able to move.
They won't be able to run, Durnick declared somberly. We shouldn't even ride them.
Durnick, Silk protested, Tower Urgas is right behind us.
They won't last a league if we try to make them run, the smith said stubbornly. There's nothing left in them.
They rode away from the river at a walk. Even at that pace, Garion could feel the trembling of his horse under him. They all looked back frequently, watching the dark-shrouded plain beyond the river as the sky grew gradually lighter. When they reached the top of the first low hills, the deep shadow, which had obscured the grasslands behind them, faded, and they were able to see movement. Then, as the light grew stronger, they saw an army of Murgos swarming toward the river. In the midst of them were the flapping black banners of Tower Urgas himself. The Murgos came on in waves until they reached the far bank of the river. Then their mounted scouts ranged out until they located the ford. The bulk of the army Tara Urgas had brought down to the plain was still on foot, but clusters of horses were being driven up from the rear as rapidly as they could be brought down the narrow cut leading from the top of the escarpment. As the first units began splashing across the ford, Silk turned to Belgareth.
Now what?
The little man asked in a worried voice.
We'd better get off the top of this hill, the old man replied. I don't think they have seen us yet. But it's just a question of time, I'm afraid.
They rode down into a little swale just beyond the hill. The overcast, which had obscured the sky for the past week or more, had begun to blow off, and broad patches of pale, icy blue had begun to appear, though the sun had not yet come up.
My guess is that he's going to hold the bulk of his army on the far side,
Belgareth told them, after they had all dismounted.
He'll bring them on across as their horses catch up. As soon as they get to this side, they're going to spread out and look for us.
That's the way I would do it,
Barak agreed.
Somebody ought to keep an eye on them, Durnick suggested.
He started back up the hill on foot.
I'll let you know if they start doing anything unusual.
Belgareth seemed lost in thought. He paced up and down, his hands clasped together behind his back, and an angry look on his face.
This is not working out the way I had expected, he said finally. I had not counted on the horses playing out on us.
Is there any place we can hide?
Belgareth shook his head.
It's all grassland. There aren't any rocks or caves or trees. It's going to be impossible to cover our tracks.
He kicked at the tall grass.
This is not turning out too well, he admitted glumly. We are all alone out here on exhausted horses.
He chewed thoughtfully at his lower lip.
The nearest help is in the vale. I think we had better turn south and make for it. We are fairly close.
How close? Silk asked.
10 leagues or so.
That's going to take all day, Belgareth. I don't think we have got that long.
We might have to tamper with the weather a bit, Belgareth conceded.
I don't like doing that, but I might not have any choice.
There was a distant low rumble somewhere off to the north. The little boy looked up and smiled at Aunt Paul.
Errand?
He asked.
Yes, dear,
she replied absently.
Can you pick up any traces of Algars in the vicinity, Paul? Belgareth asked her.
She shook her head. I think I'm too close to the orb, Father. I keep getting an echo that blots things out more than a mile or so away.
It has always been noisy, he grunted sourly.
Talk to it, Father, she suggested.
Maybe it will listen to you.
He gave her a long, hard look, a look she returned quite calmly.
I can do without that, miss, he told her finally in a crisp voice.